Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Susanna, and welcome to the Codeco podcast. In this podcast, we'll keep you up to date with the latest app development tech talk. Now, here's the show.
This is the Codeco podcast. Now, this episode was recorded on Tuesday, the 5th of March, 2024, and I am your host, Drew Freeman. And this show, I am with both my amazing co-hosts, Jennifer Bailey and Susanna Skier-Gupta.
Thanks, Drew. Today on the show, we're joined by experienced Codeco contributors and all-around cool guys, Fuad Kamal and Franklin Birawanka. Fuad specializes in mobile strategy and development for the health and fitness industries. He's also a mentor, professor, and author.
Franklin is a native mobile app developer with a telecommunications background. He actively participates in open source projects and takes pleasure in imparting knowledge as a mentor for Codeco bootcamps.
Franklin, Fuad, welcome to the show. It's great to have you both here. Now, Fuad, you've been on the show, it's been a few seasons, but you have been on our show before, and it's good to have you back. Franklin, always appreciate having new people on the show, so thank you for making time. What time is it locally for you?
For me, it's 2:21 a.m. in the morning.
Franklin, I really salute you for...
Franklin.
I really thank you for taking the arrow on this one. We're going to sort of make this one a little more roundtable-ish discussion, unlike, well, all of our podcasts are somewhat discussion-like, but this one is going to be just sort of shooting around, trying to find out a list of favorites. You know, as developers, we sort of fall into those blocks of what sits in my taskbar, in my dock. The things that I rely on, the things that I could not operate without, the things that when a colleague says, why don't you try this one? You're lost. So we're going to be talking to two very good and experienced engineers about what is their popular tools of the day. And Fuad, I'm going to start with you. Before we get into it, Fuad, give me a little bit of background into you, your platforms, and what you work on.
Sure. So currently, I'm pretty much focused on Android. Before that, I was doing iOS, and sometimes I have to go back and forth between both platforms. I'm doing Android, but I'm on a team that's developing an app for both platforms. So we have to test, like, for example, a chat app. So we have to test both platforms at the same time, regardless of what code base you're using.
And Franklin, how about you?
Well, I originally started with iOS, and then I started learning Android last year when I did the Android bootcamp. So now I'm going to be like a mix and match, like a Fuad, kind of.
Wonderful. And then I have Jen and Suze on my sides here, at least from my point of view with the five rectangles that I have, that I have a good balance of Android and iOS. I come from the world entirely of iOS, so we should have a good mix all around. So let's start, obviously, as we've talked about platforms, let's talk about the IDEs. Now, in iOS and in general, you don't get a whole lot of wiggle room. Now, I do know that people do tend to mess around with some of the other IDEs. I'm an Xcode person. I don't really use anything besides Xcode for my development environment. Suze, or any of your iOS experience for the rest of you folks, have you used anything else to basically do your work until you need to actually build?
For coding, Basically it's Xcode, yeah, pretty much. And even within Xcode, like Playgrounds and stuff, like it's within the IDE usually.
Mm-hmm. I very rarely use BBEdit, but it's more, I use it more as like a clipboard to bring stuff back and forth from Xcode, which probably there are better ways to do that. I'm a little bit curious, I haven't done this, but multiple people have said to me that they use Visual Studio Code alongside Xcode, often in order to, like, people are, these days people are saying so they can run Visual Studio Code with like Copilot in it, you know, with an AI tool in it. And then, you know, obviously we need Xcode for the, like, to build.
Right. But I do know that there are people who have actually bundled it down to just using the Xcode build command line interface and will use Studio or Visual or BB Edit. I do use BB Edit for certain tool functions, but I think of it more as an editor than an integrated development environment.
Oh, yeah.
So let's flip over to the Android side. Is it just Android Studio and that's it? Or is there other things that make it work for you? Jen, let's start with you.
All right. Generally, I like to use Android Studio. I believe people can use IntelliJ. I've had good luck putting Copilot on all my editors, including Xcode. There was a way to do that. So I've got AI in all of my editors. And one cool product, I don't know if it's still kept up, but years ago when Android was new, they had MIT App Inventor. And that was a fun way to build an app online for people who had no programming experience. And it had more of a Scratch-like interface.
Oh, how fun.
So sometimes there's tools like that. So sometimes I look for third-party tools. They're usually not apps themselves. There are academic tools for learning Kotlin and for trying to learn about Android. But I mostly just use Android Studio if I'm actually building an app.
Franklin?
Well, same. I also use Android Studio, but Jennifer said something about Scratchpads. So in the terms of Scratchpads, well, they're not really considered IDEs, but more like things that you run to just write small scripts. Something like Playgrounds or Kotlin Playgrounds. They're called Playgrounds in both Xcode and in both iOS and Android. But like Kotlin Playgrounds or Swift Playgrounds, where you're just writing just code, but without any purpose of building the app. But just writing small snippets to like test different functions.
Fod, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much the same. Bulk of my work is in Android Studio. I do use IntelliJ, but not for Android work. Like sometimes I also teach like Android and Kotlin. So for just learning, like isolating Kotlin by itself, IntelliJ is great. Pretty much like JetBrains is the ultimate developer of IDEs, no matter what the platform is, even back in Flash platform days. So, but it's just first party is usually what you have to stick with because of, you know, to be in the cutting edge. But luckily for us in Android world, JetBrains is the one who makes the IDE. So that's great. The playgrounds for Android also like, or for Kotlin, there's a web version. Like it's just, you type it into a web browser and on the kotlinlang. And that's like really fast. You don't have to fire up an IDE and all that. So that's really useful. But yeah, pretty much Android Studio for actual Android work. And then playgrounds I use a lot for just testing out small pieces of code.
We've spoken on a previous episode about moving from XML to Compose. And we're going to be talking about the same thing on UIKit moving off to Swift UI. Let's talk about laying out your interfaces. I mean, there's so much out there from just doing it straight in the IDE itself to things like Figma. What are some of the things that you've come in contact with? And Fuad, I already see you nodding, so I'm gonna turn it over to you.
I mean, you mentioned Figma, so I mean, I've been getting into that a lot more. But like with big dev teams, especially, you know, you always, the UX people are using Figma and they're handing over Figma designs. But even just for prototyping, wireframing, like Figma is really cool. It's getting better and better. Like they have this new, what's it called? There's like a lightweight thing that's within Figma. FigJams are really cool. And it's like, and you can do like a live, like you can do a Zoom session and just open up a FigJam and like just whiteboard and sketch stuff out. So we use it a lot at the last startup I was at. So it's just really useful. For wireframing stuff out and designing stuff. But now like I'm using for my students now. So like we used to use Adobe XD, but like Adobe tried to buy Figma and I guess that just fell through recently.
yeah.
Which I think is actually a good thing. But anyway, that aside, so we used to use XD for the students and now I just switched to Figma because basically Adobe stopped supporting XD even though the sale wasn't complete. So I don't know if they're going to change that. But anyway, Figma now has all these templates that you can just jump into Figma and create like a mobile app like right away. Like just use a template or a website template and you have like all the little pieces there. To start off with, you can just rearrange them, copy, paste. It's really easy to use. So I really like that.
Isn't there also some back end part where you can then export that as like Swift UI? I think there is.
One of the companies I worked at, there was like basically we didn't really use it because like the code you actually get is always questionable. Like, and that may change and make it better, but like for developers, usually like it's just the main benefit of having the Figma there is like you can like mouse over stuff and see right away, like, oh, what's the color? What's the pixels or what's the density? Like there's like UI clues that you can get that really quickly.
The specs are right there.
Exactly. So Figma is really easy to work with in that respect, but we don't really use the code generation. I don't know if anyone else has a different experience with that.
Franklin, how about you? What are you using for layout and design? Well,
for the layout inspection, I was actually talking about the internal tools. So like both Android Studio and Xcode have a way to inspect the layout inside internally when the app is running. And for the iOS side, we also have another tool called Reveal. Reveal can also do an introspection of the app, and you can see down to the windows, down to the layering, and rotate it around 3D and all that. That's using the Reveal app. So although Xcode has its own internal tool, still Reveal is a better choice for me when I'm doing an inspection of the live running app.
I've actually been really taken with SwiftUI, and I get the same impression from Jetpack Compose in that it's very easy to assemble the base UI directly as you're doing the coding. And as a result, it's easy to think in that sense of design without thinking about all of the what the state will be and how the interactions will work. Suze, Jen, what do you use for design?
I was curious how Figma compares to Canva. And I'll be honest, I usually use Google Drawings because it's very handy. And but I don't have to do super professional looking wireframes. But I find Google Drawings is a great quick go-to to make a quick drawing.
I mean, I'll say, okay, for work, so I work in a tiny team, one of whom, there are four of us, but one of the four is a graphic designer. So what do I use for design? Well, usually I use Braden, our designer. But when I'm trying to communicate something like, oh, what if we do this? I draw, and I draw on my iPad. So I use, like, you know, the Apple Pencil on the iPad. But I'm aware, like, Figma's ubiquitous. You know, we started when we started working together several years ago using Sketch, but I think that went away. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if it's actually gone, but we're not using it anymore. We're using Figma. So I should learn that one of these days.
Ford, you?
Yeah, I also wanted to mention like Photoshop. Like I've used that forever, like since the 90s. Mm. And I still use it even today, like especially if I want an app icon. Like that's, or like now recently, like Android just switched to like making it much easier to use vectors for all the assets. But I still use Photoshop sometimes in conjunction with some other tools to create vectors. But like there's like some pretty cool plugins that you can use with Photoshop to just like spit out all different icons. And I used to use that for iOS too. Like you need all the different assets for different sizes for a given icon asset. So you just use a plugin and then you just put in your source and it's like it creates everything for you. There's like a really good website I used to use. I still use it.
I know what you're talking about. I've used this too.
We'll include the website in the show notes. I also use Photoshop for especially for icon design, sometimes for touching up graphic elements for the app. And then I just remembered one other that I use for a lot of layout, and that's Omni Graffle. And Omni is a company that's been around. It predates OS X because the Omni used to develop for Next Step. And Omni Graffle is this wonderful, it can be used for thought process. It can be used for organizational charts. It can be used for rudimentary graphics. But at the same time, it can also use stencils, which are elements from something else. And I will use iOS wireframe elements and just move them around. So Omni Graffle is one that I've really, really enjoyed to use.
I wanted to say a couple things about icons. One is, thank goodness, it's easier now because now we can just put our 1024 by 1024 image and App Store Connect does the, or some behind the scenes, we're getting all of our sizes. And the other thing I was going to say, so Jen brought up Canva, and I use Canva as well. Canva, it just stuns me every time I try it. Like, it's, whoa, there's so much in there. I have used Canva for icon design, for stuff I'm playing with, not stuff I've released to the App Store. And I sit with the same question. Is that okay? Like, what's the legality of using Canva assets in apps that we release and hope to profit from? And I don't know the answer to that. And it's not clear in Canva's terms and conditions. It's clear if you are making digital products and you are starting with Canva designs and modifying them, that's okay. But if you're using their assets in an app you sell, it's a gray area. So I don't know if we have any other Canva users on here who've used it as a, you know, as an indie dev.
I suppose I should announce at this point that this is just our general popular list. We are not getting endorsed for any of these products that we're mentioning. There are no kickbacks on this one. This is just developers to developers. What do you think will help you out?
Now, I was going to answer the Susanna's question. I've used it, but I never thought about the legality until this moment. So I was also wondering the same thing in my head now. Did what I do, was it legal or not? So I just thought about it right now, and I was like, okay. It was just a question that went through my head, but I never actually thought about it myself.
Yeah, I do wonder, because like Canva has icon sets built in. So let's say you're making your own, you know, cute little camera app, as I was doing to play around the other day. And, you know, you can find an adorable like camera icon and then drop a pretty gradient behind it. And then if you put that in the right size square and export it, boom, there's your icon. So can I sell that app now? I mean, I couldn't sell it, because if I were to put that into App Review, Apple would be like, there's a camera right in your phone, rejected. But I do wonder about that.
Yeah.
But maybe it gets you part of the way there and then you do more with it in another program. You know,
so on a similar note, I mean, it's not Canva. I don't know what the answer to the Canva question, like legality wise, but like if you have a page subscription to Midjourney, you can generate assets and you own all the rights for that. So you can sell those. You can do whatever you want with that. So I have used Midjourney to like get ideas or like modify or have a starting point for an app icon. And it does, if you use the right prompts, like you can get pretty decent results a lot of times. And with each iteration, they're getting better at it. So it's, and again, you can use it totally legally.
I've used DALL-E for similar, although I don't think I'm using the right prompts, because I've used it and then thought, oh, not that.
Okay, I'm going to change speeds on us, because we could, any one of these topics that we're looking at today, we could spend the entire show just going around, and I want to get through as much as I can. So I'm going for quantity with quality. I want to talk networking, and not the way that you might be expecting. One of the things that a developer will deal with a lot in networking is either designing or dealing with endpoints at a server. And this requires testing. And we don't necessarily want to do our initial testing by writing up a quick software program. So what kind of software have you been using to test endpoints and do that kind of client-to-server communication testing with? I will start that ball rolling by saying that there's two that I fall down on a lot. Not fall down, but use a lot. And that is Postman. And the other one is called Rapid API. Now, again, I'm coming from the Apple OS world. So, you know, your mileage will probably vary if you're a Windows developer. But, Fuad, let's start with you on this one.
Sure. I mean, there was a tool. I even forget the name of it now because I stopped using it because they got bought out. But it was a really good, like, Mac-only tool. But then I started using Postman on top of that. And then the other tool went away. So I was like, okay, Postman is the way to go. And then there's Swagger, which is nice because it will tell you, like, when your backend people change the API on you, it will automatically update. And it's pretty useful for testing as well. But I mean, I think Postman is what I use the most on the desktop.
Yeah, Swagger is definitely helpful for knowing what your API menu looks like. Franklin, have you done any of this work?
Yes, I've done a little bit of it. I was also using Postman. But originally, Postman couldn't generate some of the networking code because sometimes you just want to copy and paste and test it out. But the first app I was using, you called it Rapid API. Mm-hmm. I think I know it as Pause. It Pause was bought by Rapid API. Mm-hmm. I still know it as Pause. Yeah. But then as time has evolved, the app has not been updated. So it still generates code, but it generates the old style of URL session mm-hmm. and the old style of coding. So I just moved over to Postman. That's what I use now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was using too. I was using Pause and then they got bought out and everything changed. So I was like, this is not working.
Jen, do you want to add anything?
I'm with the majority. I tend to use Postman the most and I haven't explored a lot of others.
Okay.
Maybe one thing I can add is that beyond monitoring, sometimes you want to do inspection. Like you want to see the actual packet going and coming back with data. And you want to do it from a simulator on app. And for that one, there are like two choices, either Proxyman or Charles. And those are like,
oh yeah,
also involved in networking. Charles is, I think, the more old school one. It's as old school as I know anyway. And then Proxyman is the more new, more modern markup. I don't know if there's a Windows equivalent of Proxyman though.
Yeah, I every company I go to says just set Charles up on your end, and I inevitably at every company I'm with, Charles has some little finicky, doesn't work this way, doesn't work that way, and I wind up going to Proxyman, and Proxyman is just wonderful, except both of them little pricey.
Oh, interesting. So I worked on tutorials here at Codeco for both of those, and I was wondering where Charles fit into this. So
can I ask you guys, does Proxyman work on the like mobile client too? Because that's one benefit of Charles. You can run it on your desktop, but you can also run it on the mobile device.
Yeah.
Yes, Proxyman can run on your, okay, I know it can run on your iOS device. I'm not sure about Android device, but iOS device, it has a companion app. Like when you subscribe for 1 year, you get a companion app on the iOS side, and that also can do recordings and send files.
I'm pretty sure Proxyman does have an Android equivalent. I will have to check. If it does, we'll have it in the show notes.
Yeah, these should be really juicy show notes, you guys.
Yeah. So we've talked about getting the data from client to server, server to client. We've talked about listening to the data travel. Network monitoring kind of goes more along the lines of IT than software development. Do you find yourself doing any kind of net mon?
In my case, it's mostly a troubleshooting method, less a development method. Mm-hmm. Like when things don't work as you expect, that's when you go to those tools. But you don't start, maybe you can start out with Proxyman, but like, I mean with Postman, you can start out with Postman to see the data. But Proxyman is only used when something has gone wrong. At least that's my experience.
Mm. And then there's tools built into the IDEs on both sides, like in Android Studio and Xcode. So like a lot of times, like we had an app that we were troubleshooting, like we came into a legacy project and like it was making a million API calls or should be making one. But you can see those spikes pretty clearly when you're looking mm-hmm. at, you know, in those network tools that are built into the IDE.
The instrumentation tools for Xcode are outstanding. And again, I wish I could comment more about the Android side. Jennifer, are there instrumentation style tools for Android?
Yes, there are. So there's quite a few. And I think you could rely on them quite a bit to troubleshoot for something like that.
And that's all part of Android Studio?
Yes, and there's a lot built into the device itself under the developer menu. So there's quite a few profiling tools and things in there, too, that you can work with.
And actually, I can't think of, like, is there any profiling tool that's in Xcode that we don't have in Android? Franklin, maybe like you might be more familiar with that.
The one I can say is that network monitoring tool that we have in Android Studio. We have something similar in instruments, but the weird thing, it only works with real devices. It doesn't work with simulators. I do not know why they did it like that. It's a weird design choice. But the one in Android Studio can work with the emulator.
Huh.
So not sure about why that is. Yeah.
Thank you for that.
It's in instruments. It was introduced like 2 years back. But the lack of simulator support is what turned me off it.
That's interesting. Also, like, I don't know, does this work on Xcode? But like, we can debug Bluetooth connections. even using the emulator on Android. Can you do that on iOS?
I don't know.
I don't think so. I think that's also a real device.
Oh, Bluetooth. Bluetooth development-wise has two worlds. It has old Bluetooth development, which is a nightmare, and new Bluetooth world, which is the BTLE. And the BTLE is much easier to debug. The old Bluetooth, that's taking me back to decades and many NDAs. Let's talk about something that every developer has to work with, and that is documentation. And I know that you have a choice in the Apple world of either going through the documentation that lives with Xcode, going to the website, but going beyond that, going beyond just the simple documentation, how do you obtain things? Do you tend to prefer hard written book? Do you tend to prefer ebooks? What works best for your documentation needs, and not just documentation, but learning in general? Franklin?
I would say for documentation, there are like two tools I rely on. One is called Dash. I don't know. It has a collection of documents for almost everything. And you can hook it up with shortcuts, like from Alfred or from whatever. So you can just highlight a word and it will find it for you. And can even, like, let's say you're on Xcode, it can only search the Apple Docs specifically for that. So for documentation, I think there is no better than Dash. But, like, Dash is purely based on whatever the company is giving you. There is another tool called a companion app for Swift UI. It's sold on the App Store, but it's really detailed Swift UI. It doesn't do all of Apple's frameworks. It specializes in just the Swift UI framework. So I'd say those are the two most used tools, Dash and the companion app for Swift UI. It has a really long name.
Swift UI Companion.
Yeah, Swift Companion for Swift UI.
Swift UI Companion, it's the one that sits in the menu bar and just...
Yeah. And you can search for things and do all sorts of things.
Yeah, I love Swift UI Companion. I try to, like, farm it out on every developer I ever meet who's doing Swift UI work, because it not only gives you quick lookup, but it'll give you sample code that is actually playable in the documentation. So you can move arguments for calls around and see how that affects things.
Oh, that's really good. Yeah, I looked at that and then I thought, it's not inexpensive. And I thought, that is not inexpensive. But something I love that is in some way similar, it's not our stuff, so I don't know. Is it okay to say stuff that's not our stuff? But Mark Moykins, his company is Big Mountain Studio, his whole shtick is visual books. And so he goes through with like Swift UI mastery and has like picture after picture after picture. And then how did I get this effect? Here's the code. Let me walk you through exactly what I did. And then he also has videos and like sample projects. And, you know, it's not quite as seamlessly integrated as you're describing with the Swift UI Companion. But it's good stuff. If you like to just like flip through and be like, I want to do that. How do you do that? It's great for that.
I've seen a series of books like that for things like shaders, so that you can get really down to the deep metal layer and how those effects are actually created, talking about the mathematics, taking you through the steps, and I really enjoy those kind of things.
Oh, that'd be so useful for that. Yeah. We'll be back with more of our interview with Fuad and Franklin in a moment.
Source code control. Now, source code control has gone through so many changes over so many years. And if you're really, really old school Apple, you remember Projector, which was part of the Macintosh Programmers Workshop IDE. But we have gone through this and that and the other. And the word now is, for the most part, Git. We have Git websites, we have GitHub, we have GitLab, we have many Gits. Matter of fact, Atlassian has its own, and theirs is Bitbucket. But what is your client tool for Git? Do you prefer the command line approach, or do you prefer the GUI approach? Fuad, why don't we start with you on this one?
So I have a hard and fast favorite for Git client. I'm a very visual person. I don't like the command line, and I'd never remember any of the commands, because maybe because I don't use it as much. But I love Tower. Git Tower is amazing. It's awesome. If I ever go to a company and they don't like provide license, I'll just pay for it myself. So it's that, to me, that's a really nice tool. There's another one that's really visual and looks really cool called Git Kraken, but I could just never quite like grok that as much. It's just, I don't know what it was, but it looks really cool. But Tower, I mean, anything that you can do on command line, the biggest holdup with IDEs for Tower, I mean, for Git, is like usually, well, there's some subset of things you have to use command line for. But Tower, I have not found anything you can't do with their IDE that you can do on the command line. So it's pretty much feature for feature. It's pretty awesome. And then for, like you mentioned in the notes, for conflicts, I love Kaleidoscope. I mean, I've been using it forever, and maybe it's a little bit old school, but like it works really well, and they just keep making it better. And it integrates with Tower, so like, case closed.
I haven't used Kaleidoscope in years. I've actually switched to BBEdit for my comparisons, my searches, for my side-by-sides. But I used to use Kaleidoscope all the time. Franklin, how about you on clients?
My client of choice is Fork. It's called Fork. I used to be a Git Tower guy. Then they changed subscriptions, and then I was like, it's for Git. So I simply switched to Fork, but I still pay for Kaleidoscope for comparisons, because merge conflicts, they don't look as good in Fork, and Kaleidoscope is like, it can do like a three-way merge and everything. So I think Kaleidoscope for comparisons, and then for the client itself, it's Fork.
And Kaleidoscope even supports image comparisons. It's pretty amazing.
I love Atlassian's tools, and I know Jira is becoming last decade's news and all of that, but I like the Bitbucket client. It's called SourceTree. It does work with any Git, whether it's self-hosted, corporate hosted, cloud hosted, it doesn't matter. And I've always liked it. I agree with you that I love the look of Git Kraken, but again, it's just one of those things that my brain just hasn't wrapped around it yet.
I think we do have to just appreciate that they called it Git Kraken and that their app icon features a Kraken monster. So, you know, they should get points for that, even if people ultimately realize our recommendation is Tower.
I think whoever designed it is a really good designer. It looks really pretty. And it looks like some of the features they show, like on their website, it looks like, wow, this looks really neat for comparisons. But just not as easy to use, I think, as Tower.
I know. So I strongly suspect I'm the person with the most junior dev skills on this discussion. And I'm working with a couple other people, one of whom's more experienced, to make an app we're hoping for an upcoming conference. And we're confusing ourselves, the two of us who are less experienced, in working with Git. And the more experienced guy said, okay, right away at the end of this call, I want you both to download GitHub Desktop. And just please stop using the command line and try and, you know, like improve your understanding by using GitHub Desktop. And so that is, for somebody who's new, that is a starting place. But as somebody who's used like command line for many years, just because I used to work for a Unix company, there's stuff you can't do with GitHub Desktop, but it is free and it's graphical. So that's there for people who are new and looking for that, you know, the easiest price point.
Drew was talking about the Bitbucket client. That's, I think, also free.
I think SourceTree is free too. I think you're right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also, if you're trying to like grok Git for the first time, I really recommend, like, if you Google like Git tutorial, you'll see a bunch from Atlassian. They have some amazing tutorials. I think that they're really good. And they walk you through even the different types of like Git flow and the different types of methodologies you can use in Git.
Yeah, I think that's the trick of it. It is so powerful, and there are so many different workflows that are supported, that it's a lot.
Jen, you were going to say something?
Oh, I enjoy using GitHub Desktop, and that's usually adequate. I was a big command line user years ago, but I like to use GitHub Desktop or VS Code, or what's built into the editor usually is adequate for me. And I'm with you, Drew. I really liked the Atlassian tools as well. So I used Bitbucket before GitHub was free, and I really like that tool.
Okay. Let's have a quick, very quick, let's knock them down, throw down war here. I'm just going to go down the line. I'm going to ask you your name. I'm going to say your name, and you tell me your browser of choice. Fawd?
Safari.
Suze?
Chrome.
Franklin?
Safari.
Jen?
Chrome.
And I'm Safari, so it's 3-2. Now, obviously, we're going to have to get more people on the show. It's interesting because Chrome...
Why didn't anyone say Bing?
Not Bing. What's the new one from Microsoft? It's got the sort of wave...
Edge.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're on to personal productivity. So, Jen, let's start with you. What is your productivity tools of choice?
As far as documents, I use Google Docs as much as possible because it's all cloud and it's simple and free. And I don't always have my Office installed. So other than that, I would use Microsoft Office. But I use Google Docs and they're adequate for probably the vast majority of what I do.
Suze?
It depends on what I'm doing. I use a whole bunch of different things. I do use Google Docs. I use Text Edit a weird amount of time, but I like it. And I have it set to show Comic Sans in a huge font, so you guys can all just cringe as you listen. I use Apple Notes a lot. I use BB Edit sometimes. I write on my iPad in Noteful. And sometimes I just write on paper, which is made from trees that are flattened.
Paper OS. Paper OS shall always be there for you. It doesn't run out of battery.
Exactly.
Fawd, how about you?
So if today you told me that all the apps are going to like disintegrate, like the world's coming to an end, and you can save one app, it would be Bare Notes for me. I rely on that for everything. Like my life depends on Bare Notes. It supports like so many things, Markdown. I just love it. I journal all the time. I use Bare Notes, but I have to say, like Suze was saying, like there's actually when you write with a pen, it activates a different part of your brain. So I have a favorite fountain pen. I've had since I was really young, that my uncle gave me. And like, that's like writing with a fountain pen on a notepad is really key for me too.
Yeah. It's a sensory experience.
I took calligraphy in college. I love writing with a fountain pen.
Franklin, what are your choices?
For note-taking, the app I use is Quiver, mostly because all the others I tried, formatting code was so hard. So Quiver is my choice because formatting code is very easy. I just write the statement that I want, and then I just say format this Swift, and it just does that. It builds everything in small, small boxes. So it's Quiver is my choice for taking notes. For developer notes.
Are you more a Office or cloud, Google Cloud person?
I'm more Office, but the work I do involves Google Docs. You just can't get away from it. It's everywhere. So it's because you have to collaborate with people. That's when Google Docs comes in. But if I had the choice, it would be Office.
See, I'm in the same boat. Everybody's been switching to Google Docs. I don't know if it's a personal distrust of Google having all of my documentation there. It's that concept of having my files local. But I do trust Dropbox, so I don't know if that says anything, that I trust Dropbox more than I trust Google. Granted, I also trust being able to encrypt my files. Now, interestingly enough, as much as I love Office, and I will admit, I worked on the team, I love Excel. I know people hate Excel. I'm one of those people who not only uses Excel, but I use it as a database. I use it as columnar paper. I use it, you know, if I could roll it up, I use it as a newspaper to swat the kids off the front yard. But as much as I love Word and Excel, I've switched to Keynote. for Apple. Because Apple Keynote is just, I think, one of the best pieces of software ever developed. My reasoning behind that was that was the first piece of software that Jobs said, I don't want to use Office for this anymore. Make me a piece of software that I won't get pissed at. And, well, it's Jobs who got pissed at everything. So BB Edit for the text editing I talked about earlier.
I will say one of the things that I really love about Google Docs, in contrast to a lot of other shared things that I've worked with, is I really like just the, when you're editing somebody else's work and you can change it to suggesting and it doesn't mess around with their file, but they can see it and choose to accept it or not. And perhaps there are other easy cloud-based shared collaborative tools, but I find that one, that feature of Google Docs, very straightforward and useful in a group setting.
I have to say Google Docs seems to get that sync thing like better than anybody else. Microsoft, Apple, like Google Docs by far, it does the co-editing thing really, really well. Mm-hmm. Better than anybody else.
Yeah, I found like for life stuff like notes or reminders on, you know, we're a mostly Apple family, the stuff that supposedly can be collaborative does not actually seem to work that way. So that's frustrating.
I need a lot of organization tools. So Google Calendar, I could not live without it. I think that would be my single most important thing. And then I'm using an older, I need a to-do list desperately. And I have not found one that I like better than Habitica. And it's gamified, and I like that feature, but I don't usually have time for the gamified feature. But the way that it has options, because you can have habits or a list and different, and dailies, I cannot find another to-do list that is better than Habitica as far as my needs. And I can tailor it to all of my needs. I've tried every to-do list there is, and I've stuck with Habitica for 5 or 6 years now.
And I'm pretty sure, I think Habitica is open source too. So you can.
It is.
Yeah.
I wrote a Google action to add one to a list once, and I had a lot. So you can play with it. You can build onto it if you want to.
Yeah. How fun. Thank you for reminding us of that.
It'd be great for developers. Yeah. Developers who want to do a portfolio piece because they have groups of people who, they have a guild for people who want to develop. So you can ask questions of people who are, and they have a whole community around that. So if you're looking for an open source project, that would be fun.
Yeah. There's a whole subreddit for it.
Well, there's a Reddit for everything.
Yeah, true, true.
There are subreddits we don't even want to go into.
Definitely not.
I know there's Kindle for reading. There's also Apple Books. Are there any other choices?
Oh, do we want to talk about this? This is a whole episode. This is a whole genre of podcast, Drew.
What are we reading? Is it PDFs?
Yeah, good questions.
That's true. Kindle handles both, doesn't it?
Well, so does Apple Books, but Apple Books has a weird thing where if you're opening a PDF on an iOS or iPadOS device, it works just fine. But if you open a PDF on your Mac, it opens up in preview, which is so annoying. It doesn't sync or anything.
Yeah.
If it's a PDF for like a work or learning thing, I like to open it on my iPad in a note-taking app where I can add a layer of notes on it. But then, you know, then depending on what app you've chose, maybe that's searchable, maybe that's not. It really depends on what you're reading and what you're doing with it. And, you know, I am an avid Kindle user, but I think of that as more pleasure reading. I rarely read work stuff on the Kindle, although sometimes, but I can't write on my Kindle, and I like being able to do that.
I think one of the things that separates the Kindle from the Apple app for me is the way it organizes. And the search capabilities on Apple tend to make me a little happier. But I agree with Todd that I am very much annoyed at the fact that on the Mac, I am bumped to what I consider to be an inferior PDF reader.
Okay. In my case, I simply treat, for EPUBs, I import them into Apple Books. But for PDFs, I import them into Notability. because Notability can sync with your iPad and you can get to write on it. But I have the Notability before subscription because we were grandfathered in. So the new ones, everyone pays a subscription. But as we were grandfathered in, because it was caused a big controversy when they switched to subscription. So as we were grandfathered in, so I still have my rights to import as many PDFs as I want. And it can sync using Dropbox, using Google Drive, using a whole bunch of things it can sync with.
Yeah, I'm in the exact same boat as Franklin. I just follow the same thing. If I want to mark it up, I'm using Notability. I'm also grandfathered in, so I have all the features. And I use Apple Books when I want to like read an EPUB.
That's very cool. As an educator, I realize that a lot of publishing companies that I've used have their own reader, and you're kind of confined to that depending on the publishing company. So I have sometimes some e-textbooks that we just have to use their reader.
Mm.
I think that was one of the things that hobbled O'Reilly, because O'Reilly used to be the zoo of books. Because
so many delicious titles, so much good stuff.
So many fantastic titles. I'm turning to look at my bookshelf, and I can see at least four O'Reilly on the first shelf I look at right in a row. I remember them going through their own proprietary reader.
Yes.
And I think that may have been, I think proprietary readers were one of those things that hobbled some of these publishing companies.
I find that in general, people don't like them, especially, or they can be limited. So they're only available on Android, or they're only available on iOS, or they're only available on the web. So I found them to not be particularly popular, and I try to steer away from resources that are married to that.
That's one thing I love about Codeco, actually, is like you can get all the formats, PDF, EPUB, you can view the book on the web. And the nice thing about the web is like it's, and in the EPUB, so you can get the updated, but like if you look on the web, you're getting the latest version, and you can switch even between versions if you want.
Mm-hmm.
And you can even highlight, although I think I prefer highlighting with like, you know, Apple Pencil or whatever, but like that you can even highlight on the website and take notes on the website.
I love how we can bookmark and stuff too. So I agree. I enjoy using our Codeco resources a lot more than some other publishing companies for sure. And then I don't have a lot of complaints because students can use it no matter what kind of equipment they own. Because I really hate for people to have to buy equipment to read a book. Because they're already buying the book, you know.
So, who has a piece of technology listening in on them right now? And if they do, what's its name? Jen?
Oh, gosh, I've got a lot of those. Don't say the G word in my house. It's like a choir going off in the background. But I have Google Assistants throughout my house. I use them religiously. They're very helpful, especially with, I have ADHD. So they're very, very helpful because I can tell it to remember something for me. I can add it to Google Keep. So I have several Keep lists that I know the name. And a lot of times by the time I reach pen and paper, or unlike my phone, I've forgotten what I need to do or write down. And then I set timers and alarms all day long, too. So if I have a meeting or like this podcast, I had an alarm set for when I need to log in. And it's when I leave my house, I'm in a pickle because I'm always yelling out to my assistant to take notes of stuff and it's not there.
Well, I'll get back to calendaring and appointments in a moment, but let's talk about the smart speakers first. How about you, Suze?
We have two quite elderly, like I think Gen 1 or soon thereafter Amazon Echoes, the Alexas, and I like them, you know? I mean, they aren't that smart. They're not very smart speakers, but you know, you can connect them via Bluetooth and Spotify can play through them. And that's pretty much all they're doing. Ever so often, like, you know, right after the Barbie movie came out, they had some Barbie theme and you could say something to it and it'd say, "I hope you have a fantastic day," and then play sparkly sounding music. And I like that for a little while. So.
Franklin, do you have a smart speaker?
I do have a very old Amazon Echo that's in the sitting room, but that's mostly, I think, for the kids and everybody else. I don't have it in the office here. And even on my laptop itself, I disable Siri from mentioning anything because I kept accidentally clicking it all the time. it began to not bug me. So apart from that, I only have Siri on the phone.
Ford?
Yeah, so I tried the Apple ones for a while. But in general, the non-Apple ones, like the big concern in our household is like privacy. And I think all of them, except for the Apple ones, like they do the processing on the cloud. So that means it's always recording you and always sending your data to the cloud. So if there's a breach or like you just, or if it's a company you don't trust, or you just never know, right? So for us, it just feels weird to have a microphone listening in on you at all time. And even the Apple ones, even though it's processed on device, like it just didn't set well with the family. It's like, okay, we got rid of them pretty quickly. So it's our house is pretty much, there's no cameras and there's no microphones.
Yeah, I don't like the cameras because everything I keep hearing from Ring, I keep hearing is that your video is being shared with this company and that group and et cetera. I will admit, definitely do this, the Siri thing here. I started because I was afraid I'd set it off. But we got onto the topic briefly, so I want to go back to it, and that's calendaring. Again, we're sort of in cloud versus non-cloud here. Most calendaring actually does have syncing with other things, but I have just never been able to make my way onto Google Calendar. I just...
Fascinating.
And since I'm so Siri heavy, I keep wondering, should I try to... find some kind of balance between Apple Calendar and Google Calendar, but I haven't. Fawad?
So I use a combination of Apple Calendar and Google Calendar. My default thing is Apple Calendar, but for integration, I use like my Calendly, like anyone wants to set a meeting with me, it's always through Google Calendar. And the biggest pain point I have like right now is like in my actual Apple Calendar, every meeting is like, sometimes they're double, sometimes they're quadrupled. So it's like, because I have a service through my email thing that like my email server that will like create, you know, it'll duplicate the calendar. I try turning it off and just somehow like it's just getting out of control. Like, so in Apple Calendar, I've like turned off a bunch of the calendars just so they don't repeat. But then like I have to make sure I'm not missing out on events. It's just, it's really weird. So I don't have a good solution, but I love Apple Calendar just because that's what I use. But I wish it worked better.
Okay. I had the same problem as Forward using both Apple Calendar and Gmail Calendar. And I would also have the problem of multiple, like the call is multiple times in the calendar app. But Fantastico solved all of those problems for me. Because what it does, it merges all three events and then gives them like a rainbow color, meaning they belong to more than one calendar. So you don't have that issue. And with Fantastico, it has a companion contacts app, which it also syncs to. So getting the contacts is easy. And that became my default for calendaring.
So you said Fantastico will actually take multiple events that are from the same thing and combine them?
If it's the same event from different calendars, it combines them, then puts a rainbow color. Like let's say a Google Calendar is red and Apple Calendar is blue. So it will combine them and you will see half blue, half red. It's just a dot, but it indicates these are from two different sources because it syncs with all of them. What I really like is that I mostly use it for syncing meetups because I can't attend every meetup. So I just want to know what the topic of the meetup is, like for meetup.com. Then I'll decide if I'm going to attend or not. Because you can also accept from inside the calendar, inside the Fantastico.
I know, I'm watching our chat and I know people are already like, I'm going to check that one out right after. Suze, how about you on calendaring?
Well, so I kind of use a double system. So I use Google Calendar and then I also, because this is fun for me and also helps solidify it in my brain, I use a planner that's like a paper planner, only it's in my digital PDF note-taking app. And I use Noteful. I didn't start with Notability. I started with GoodNotes, which also went subscription. And they said, you know, if you're a subscriber, if you've paid, you can have up until GoodNotes 5 and then GoodNotes 6 and beyond, you have to pay again. And so I switched apps. But so that works for me. But I was going to say, so we used to use Cozy as a family. I could not stand their grocery app part. It just did not work for me. And I'm very picky about that. And the perfect one has not yet happened. Hopefully I'll write it someday. But anything that works, if you use a calendaring app or list making app and you've trained your family to use it, that's the one. If you've managed to train your family, use that one. So if your family all knows to look in Cozy, put things in Cozy and put new grocery items in Cozy, Right on.
It is very difficult to offboard and onboard your family to software. Jen?
Oh, I was just going to say I loved the shopping list Bring, because back in the day, or not too long ago, maybe 6 months ago and prior, it would interface with Google Assistant. So you could tell it to add things to your shopping list through the assistant. And now it doesn't integrate anymore. So, but I'm really sad because me and my daughter both use that one. And you could speak it into the assistant to add items on the shopping list.
I wish we had time to play the entire interview, but if you'd like to see the interview with all the material, watch YouTube for the full video version.
Well, we have covered a whole lot of apps today, and a whole lot of applications, and a whole lot of functions, and I cannot thank my entire team more than enough today, especially Susan and Jen for both being here today to chime in on all the things. Fawd, Franklin, I really have to thank you for joining us for this episode. It gave us a lot of insight. Franklin, again, many thanks to you.
Yes.
Striking up at the some of the latest. What time is it right now?
4 a.m. It's now 4 a.m.
It is now 4 a.m.
I thought it was coming up on 4.
Folks, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you. It was like my pleasure to be here, as always.
It was also my pleasure. I learned a few apps that I'm also going to try out right now.
We will be having another episode in just a few weeks. We are going to be talking about the difference between freelance and corporate, how to strike forth in each of those fields, and where the pros and where the cons are. We hope you'll tune in for that. And as always, leave a message on your favorite podcasting app with positive responses. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you next time.
And that's a wrap. Thanks again, everybody, for listening to the Codeco podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. And don't forget to leave a rating in your favorite podcast app. See you next time.